Hello, and welcome to today's reading of New York Times. I'm Brian Burgess, and we'll start with a front-page article from the Wednesday, May 4th edition, headlined, Draft Abortion Ruling Signals Seismic Political Shift. The Supreme Court on Tuesday confirmed that a leaked draft ruling to overturn the landmark Roe v. Wade decision was authentic, but not final, even as the disclosure triggered political upheaval with potentially broad electoral and legal consequences. While protesters gathered outside the court, chanting loudly enough for members of Congress to hear at the Capitol across the street, Democrats led by President Biden vowed to make abortion rights a defining issue of the fall midterm elections. Republicans accused liberals of orchestrating the leak to intimidate the court while Chief Justice John Roberts Jr. ordered an investigation. If this decision holds, it really is quite a radical decision, Mr. Biden told reporters. Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, the Democratic leader, called it an abomination. And Speaker Nancy Pelosi accused the court of brazenly ignoring 50 years of its own precedent. But House Republican leaders issued a joint statement calling it potentially a decision that protects our most basic and precious right, the right to life. The draft opinion by Justice Samuel Alito Jr. was circulated among justices in February with the support of at least 5 of the 9 members of the court. But a final decision is not expected to be issued until June or early July. Such drafts routinely change as they are traded among the justices, who offer suggestions, make objections, and at times even change their votes. So it is conceivable that the final result may yet be narrower than Justice Alito initially envisioned. But the disclosure of his draft made clear that a bedrock of American law for the last half century could be on the verge of being reversed. If the court follows through with some version of Justice Alito's opinion, the constitutional right to abortion, first established by the court in 1973, would be negated, and it would be left to the states to decide whether the procedure should be legal in their jurisdictions or not. The result would be a patchwork of different laws across the country, unless Congress steps in and sets a single national policy again. Such a decision by the court would successfully culminate a decades-long movement by conservatives who argued that life begins at conception, and that Roe invented a right that did not exist in the Constitution. At the same time, it would represent a devastating defeat for liberals, who sought to guard women's rights to choose the procedure against years of efforts to chip away at the ruling. The disclosure of a draft opinion in such a major case is unheard of in modern times and has thrown the Supreme Court into turmoil as it faces a stunning breach of its traditionally secret deliberations. The court has largely been immune to the sort of leaks that have been common in other major institutions, but justices, clerks, and others close to the court may find a new atmosphere of suspicion amid speculation about who is to blame and what their motivation is. Chief Justice Roberts called it a betrayal of the confidence of the court and ordered an investigation. This was a singular and egregious breach of that trust that is an affront to the court and the community of public servants who work here, he said in a statement issued by the court. In the same statement, the court affirmed that Justice Alito's draft was real, while emphasizing that no one should assume that it will necessarily reflect the final decision. Although the document described in yesterday's reports is authentic, it does not represent a decision by the court or the final position of any member on the issues in the case, the statement said. And in a related front-page story, this one by Adam Liptak, extraordinary breach delivers blow to the court's legitimacy. Sources have motives, and the leaked draft opinion overturning Roe v. Wade raises a question as old as the Roman Empire. Qui bono? Who benefits? Not the Supreme Court as an institution. Its reputation was in decline even before the extraordinary breach of its norms of confidentiality, with much of the nation persuaded that it is little different from the political branches of the government. The internal disarray the leak suggests, wholly at odds with the decorum prized by Chief Justice John Roberts Jr., was a blow to the legitimacy of the court. Relations among the justices, too, on the evidence of questioning at arguments and statements and opinions, have turned fraught and frosty. Will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts, Justice Sonia Sotomayor asked when the challenge to Roe was argued in December, as it became clear that five justices could be ready to overrule the decision. The fact of the leak cannot be separated from its substance. Only a move as extraordinary as eliminating a constitutional right in place for half a century could transform the court into an institution like any other in Washington, where rival factions disclose secrets in the hopes of obtaining advantage. Until now, a leak of this kind would have been unthinkable, said Peter G. Verniero, a former justice of the New Jersey Supreme Court. The protocol of our highest court has been seriously ruptured. The leaking itself reflects another sad step toward casting the court as a political body, which, whatever your preferred jurisprudence, is most unhealthy for the rule of law. The court sustained collateral damage in March when it emerged that Virginia Thomas, the wife of Justice Clarence Thomas, had sent incendiary text messages to the Trump White House in the weeks leading up to the January 6th attack, and that Justice Thomas not only had failed to disqualify himself from a related case, but also had cast the sole noted dissent. The harm from the leak was more direct, raising questions about whether the court is capable of functioning in an orderly way. If they followed their usual practices, the justices cast tentative votes in the case at a private meeting soon after they heard arguments on December 1st. Politico, which obtained the document, reported that five members of the court had voted to overrule Roe. Justices Thomas, Samuel Alito Jr., and the three members of the court appointed by President Trump, Justices Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett. Those five votes were in keeping with the questions those justices asked at the argument. They were also consistent with Mr. Trump's vow to appoint justices who would overrule Roe, which established a constitutional right to abortion in 1973. That lineup remains unchanged as of this week, Politico reported. After the meeting in December, the senior justice in the majority, seemingly Justice Thomas, assigned the majority opinion to Justice Alito. On February 10th, Justice Alito circulated the draft that has become public. Additional drafts have almost surely been produced since then, as Justice Alito refined his arguments, made changes to accommodate his allies, responded to criticisms in one or more draft concurrences or dissents, and crucially, worked to make sure that he did not lose his majority. The court's actual decision is not likely to land until late June. Even as Chief Justice Roberts said on Tuesday that he had ordered an investigation into what he described as an egregious breach of trust, it was not clear that the leak violated any law. As Chief Justice Warren Burger wrote in a footnote in his dissent in the Pentagon Papers case, which refused to block publication of a secret history of the Vietnam War, no statute gives this court express power to establish and enforce the utmost security measures for the secrecy of our deliberations and records. Nonetheless, he noted, the court is not powerless to root out and punish the source. I have little doubt as to the inherent power of the court to protect the confidentiality of its internal operations by whatever judicial measures may be required. In front page news about Ukraine, tears, food, and sun after weeks underground. Some flashed bright smiles and others bent over in heaving sobs, sharing the end of their hellish subterranean ordeal. Here at last were ordinary things they thought they might not live to see again. Sunlight, enough food, and escape from incessant Russian shelling. On a fleet of city buses flanked by white United Nations and Red Cross vehicles, nearly 130 women, children, and elderly people on Tuesday reached the relative safety of Ukrainian-controlled territory after weeks huddled in the belly of Mariupol's sprawling steelworks. They had sheltered in the near darkness of underground bunkers with little food or water as explosives of all shapes and sizes rained down day and night, slowly chipping away at the steel and concrete overhead that was their only protection. For some reason, I remember Easter. Easter Day, said Ina Papush, who spent 58 days underground with her daughter, Dasha. We thought it would be a holy day, and they would take a break, she said of the Russian forces. But the shelling became even heavier, Dasha said, completing her mother's thought. Leaders of the United States and Europe pressed harder on Tuesday to arm Ukraine, hinder the Kremlin, and strengthen the NATO alliance. President Biden visited a factory that makes anti-tank missiles that have been vital to the Ukrainian cause, even as President Vladimir Putin of Russia warned that they were only making matters worse. And in the parking lot of the Epicenter shopping complex in Zaporizhia, in southeastern Ukraine, evacuees from Mariupol stepped from buses, blinking in the sunshine. They were greeted by a parade of aid workers offering tea and snacks and a less than quiet place to rest in a large white tent buzzing with journalists, psychologists, and the occasional politician. Children were given candy while an air raid siren sounded briefly, ignored by all. Their evacuation was a rare but limited victory for diplomacy and an unusual concession to human dignity by Russian forces who have inflicted death and misery upon civilian populations across a broad swath of Ukraine since the war began on February 24th. Negotiators from the United Nations and the International Committee for the Red Cross brokered a deal with the Russians that allowed for the civilians to escape the Azovstal steel plant, the sprawling complex that had been their refuge. But it came only after more than 2 months of intense attacks that have turned Mariupol, once a vivacious port city, into a ruin of bomb-blasted buildings and corpse-strewn streets. In addition to 127 evacuees who fled to Zaporizhia, about 30 escaped the plant but chose to remain in Mariupol, according to the Associated Press. In the days leading up to a ceasefire that allowed the civilians to escape, Russian forces escalated their attacks on the plant, causing cave-ins that hampered rescue efforts and killing and injuring unknown numbers, according to Ukrainian officials and troops who are still there. From the evacuees, a picture began to emerge of life in Azovstal. The steel mill was like a small city with roads and buildings dating to the post-World War II era, when any big Soviet construction project included reinforced bomb shelters equipped with everything needed for long-term survival. Evacuees described bunkers, most housing 30 to 50 people, with kitchens, bathhouses, and sleeping areas. The shelters were spread out around the grounds of the complex, so there was little contact between groups hiding in different places. There, in the dark, a semblance of day-to-day life took shape. We got used to it being very dark. We had to economize food, said Dasha Papush. The soldiers brought us what they could: water, food, oatmeal. The mayor of Mariupol, Vadim Bochenko, said in a televised interview on Tuesday that more than 200 civilians were still hiding at the plant, and that more than 100,000 people remained scattered about the city. Inside Azovstal, supplies of food, water, and medicines have dwindled to critical levels. The Russians resumed shelling the plant almost immediately after international negotiators departed with the evacuees, according to the soldiers there. And in a front-page article by Anton Troyanovsky and Julian Barnes, why isn't Putin hitting harder on the battlefield? Russia's war against Ukraine has leveled cities, killed tens of thousands of people, and forced millions of others from their homes. But quietly, some military analysts and Western officials are asking why the onslaught has not been even worse. Russia could be going after Ukrainian railways, roads, and bridges more aggressively to try to staunch the flow of Western weapons to the front line. It could have bombed more of the infrastructure around the capital, Kyiv, to make it harder for Western leaders to visit President Volodymyr Zelensky in shows of unity and resolve. And it could be doing far more to inflict pain on the West, whether by cyber attack, sabotage, or more cutoffs of energy exports to Europe. Part of the reason appears to be sheer incompetence. The opening weeks of the war demonstrated vividly that Russia's military was far less capable than believed before the invasion. But American and European officials also say that President Vladimir Putin's tactics in recent weeks have appeared to be remarkably cautious, marked by a slow-moving offensive in eastern Ukraine, a restrained approach to taking out Ukrainian infrastructure, and an avoidance of actions that could escalate the conflict with NATO. The apparent restraint on the ground stands in contrast to the bombast on Russian state television, where Moscow is described as being locked in an existential fight against the West and where the use of nuclear weapons is openly discussed. The issue is whether, as the war grinds on, if Mr. Putin will change tack and intensify the war. That is a particularly urgent question ahead of the Victory Day holiday in Russia next Monday, when Mr. Putin traditionally presides over a grandiose parade marking the Soviet triumph over Nazi Germany and gives a militaristic speech. Ben Wallace, the British Defense Secretary, predicted last week that Mr. Putin would use the speech for an official declaration of war and a mass mobilization of the Russian people. American and European officials say that they've not seen any on-the-ground movements that would show any much larger push with additional troops beginning on May 9th or soon afterward. Those officials now expect a slower, grinding campaign inside Ukraine, but they do not disagree that Mr. Putin could use the speech to declare a wider war and a deeper national effort to fight it. For the moment, Mr. Putin appears to be in a military holding pattern, one that is allowing Ukraine to regroup and stock up on Western weaponry. On Monday, a senior Pentagon official called Russia's latest offensive in eastern Ukraine very cautious, very tepid. In Russia, there is a grumbling that the military is fighting with one hand tied behind its back, with the strategy and aims not understood by the public. This is a strange, special kind of war, Dmitry Trenin, until recently the director of the Carnegie Moscow Center think tank, said in a phone interview from outside Moscow. Russia has set some rather strict limits for itself, and this is not being explained in any way, which raises a lot of questions, first of all, among Russian citizens. For weeks, officials in Washington have discussed why the Russian military has not been more aggressive in trying to destroy the supply lines that sends Western arms shipments into Ukraine. Part of the answer, officials say, is that Ukrainian air defense continues to threaten Russian aircraft, and the deeper Russian planes go into Ukraine, the greater the chance they will be shot down. Russia has also struggled with its precision munitions, missiles or rockets with guidance systems. Many of those weapons have failed to work properly, and Russian supplies of the weapons are limited. Strikes on rail lines or moving convoys must be very precise to be effective. Other officials have argued that Moscow is eager to avoid damaging Ukraine's infrastructure too severely, in the possibly misguided hope that it can still take control of the country. Russia would be stuck with a huge rebuilding job if it took over cities devastated by its own bombing. A senior American defense official said that Mr. Putin may have avoided destroying Ukraine's rail network because he did not want to hurt his own ability to move equipment and troops around the country. The Russians have been more focused on destroying weapon storage areas than the rail network. American officials spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss private military and intelligence assessments. Then there is the question of why Russia hasn't hit back harder against the West. The Kremlin narrative is of an existential war with NATO being fought on Ukrainian soil, but Russia is the one taking military losses while the West maintains a safe distance and supplies weapons that kill Russian soldiers. Mr. Putin himself is warned of retaliation, but he also values ambiguity. Last year, he said that those crossing a red line would face an asymmetric, fast, and tough response, an indication that the response would come at a time and place of Moscow's choosing. Nobody really knows where the red line is, Mr. Charop, the analyst said. I don't even think that Russians know, because we are in such uncharted waters. American and allied officials have debated why Mr. Putin hasn't tried widespread or more damaging cyberstrikes. Some say that Mr. Putin has been effectively deterred. The Russian military, struggling to make gains in Ukraine, cannot handle a wider war with NATO and does not want to give the alliance any excuse to enter the war more directly. In other international news, Holy City or theme park? Jerusalem projects stir debate. A picturesque ridge in Jerusalem, steeped in ancient history, is a favorite with visitors who come to snap panoramic photographs of the domes and spires of the old city across a wooded valley below. Many believe that the ridge is the site of the Hill of Evil Counsel, where, according to Christian tradition, Judas plotted to betray Jesus. In the not-too-distant future, if developers get their way, visitors will be able to glide down from this perch on a zip line into the green valley known as the Peace Forest. The zip line is one of a number of planned attractions billed as a tourist draw and a way to ease access to sites of historical interest. The developers also envision a cable car, a pedestrian bridge, and visitor centers, along with a model farm that has already been built. But the ridge and the valley beneath it run along the highly delicate seam between predominantly Palestinian East Jerusalem and the mostly Jewish western flank of this contested city. They are part of the historical vista around the old city walls known as the Holy Basin, a terrain dotted with archaeological ruins and shrines of all three major monotheistic religions. Critics say the planned projects will turn what is left of the open, rolling landscape around the old city into a kind of Disneyland and mar the iconic skyline. Opponents also see the plans as part of a grander political strategy to erase the line between East and West Jerusalem and strengthen Israel's claim to sovereignty over all of Jerusalem. They say the intent is to emphasize the Jewish history and culture of areas loaded with religious and political sensitivities and play down their Muslim, Christian, or Palestinian character. The involvement of a private Jewish settler organization has only fueled those concerns. Nobody is saying there's not a lot of Jewish history here, said Yuri Ehrlich of Emek Sheva, an Israeli advocacy group that opposes the exploitation of cultural heritage as a political tool in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But it depends on which story you want to tell. The developers insist that the plans, some of which have been in the works for years, will pump life back into long-neglected areas that were difficult to reach, overtaken by drug dealers and prone to vandalism and arson. But they could also upset the delicate balance in Jerusalem, which is always volatile. The past month has seen a rise in tensions, especially around the old city. And most of the projects have been approved in government committees without much public scrutiny, so there has been little discussion about the possible impact. Much of the land in question has until now been open green space with little to no development. In addition to the zip line, the plans include a pedestrian suspension bridge across a preserved green space below the old city ramparts known as the Hinnom Valley, or Wadi Rababeh in Arabic, the site of ancient sacrifices and burials. A private Jewish settler organization, the City of David Foundation, or ELAD, its Hebrew acronym, is partnering with local and national government agencies to help develop the attractions. Those agencies are providing much of the financing. ELAD is dedicated to the development of what many experts believe to be the biblical City of David, the original royal city of the Israelite King David 3,000 years ago, and its environs. Its flagship project has been managing the City of David archaeological site in Silwan, a Palestinian neighborhood in East Jerusalem. More than three decades ago, ELAD began acquiring properties around the site where excavations began more than a century ago, and moving Jewish families into the houses there. Doron Spielman, the vice president of ELAD, said his group worked for the benefit of Jews, Christians, and Muslims in Jerusalem. Its mission, he said, was to bring tourists, education, and archaeology, so someone enters an entire landscape that is biblical and can connect to their historical identity and to their roots, to their DNA. Mr. Spielman said the groups opposing the development preferred to keep this area of Jerusalem in a state of disrepair and neglect so they can further their narrative that Jews and Arabs can't prosper together here under Israeli sovereignty. By strengthening Israel's presence in East Jerusalem, the group also hopes to prevent any future division of the city, while Palestinians want East Jerusalem to be the capital of a future state. In domestic news, where water is scarce, lawns are cut out and carted away. In Las Vegas, it was a perfectly decent patch of lawn, several hundred square feet of grass in a condominium community on the city's western edge. But Jamie Gonzalez, a worker with a local landscaping firm, had a job to do. Wrangling a heavy gas-powered sod cutter, Mr. Gonzalez sliced the turf away from the soil underneath, like peeling a potato. Two co-workers followed, gathering the strips for disposal. Mr. Gonzalez took little pleasure in destroying this patch of fescue, but it's better to replace it with something else, he said. The ground would soon be covered with gravel dotted with plants like desert spoon and red yucca. Under a state law passed last year that is the first of its kind in the nation, patches of grass like this, found along streets and at housing developments and commercial sites in and around Las Vegas, must be removed in favor of more desert-friendly landscaping. The offense? They are non-functional, serving only an aesthetic purpose. Seldom, if ever, walked on and kept alive by sprinklers, they are wasting a resource, water, that has become increasingly precious. Outlawing grass is perhaps the most dramatic effort yet to conserve water in the Southwest, where decades of growth and 20 years of drought, made worse by a warming climate, have led to dwindling supplies from the Colorado River, which serves Nevada and six other states, Native American tribes, and Mexico. For southern Nevada, home to nearly 2.5 million people and visited by upward of 40 million tourists a year, the problem is particularly acute. The region depends on Lake Mead, the nearby reservoir behind Hoover Dam on the Colorado, for 90% of its drinking water. The lake has been shrinking since 2000 and is now so low that original water intake was exposed last week. The regional water utility, the Southern Nevada Water Authority, has been so concerned that it spent $1.5 billion over a decade building a much deeper intake and a new pumping station, recently put into operation so it can take water even as the level continues to drop. The new law, which passed with bipartisan support, is meant to help ensure that what water there is goes further. It's an example of the kind of strict measures that other regions may increasingly be forced to take to mitigate and adapt to the impacts of climate change. And in metro area news, in New York, they're planning to protect access. Democratic leaders in Albany decried the news coming out of the Supreme Court on Tuesday, suggesting that they were considering a range of options that would help enshrine New York as a haven for women seeking reproductive care. If the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade, as it appears poised to do, New York and other states with strong support for abortion rights could see an influx of people seeking abortions and traveling from states that ban the practice. State Senator Liz Krueger of Manhattan has introduced a bill that would protect New York doctors who treat those patients by prohibiting law enforcement agencies from cooperating with out-of-state investigations on abortion cases. Other bills introduced in the New York State Senate include one sponsored by State Senator Alessandra Biaggi, who represents parts of the Bronx and Westchester County, that would establish an abortion access fund and allow taxpayers to contribute to it. And another, sponsored by State Senator Samra Brauch of Rochester, that would require health insurers who offer maternity coverage to cover abortion. Another bill from Ms. Krueger would establish an equality amendment in the state's constitution protecting a person's right to access to reproductive care, including abortion. The Senate Majority Leader, Andrea Stewart Cousins, said on Tuesday that it was an outrage that the Supreme Court is poised to reverse the rights of women in this country, and that she expected to pass legislation to reaffirm abortion rights before the end of the session. Certainly, we do not want anybody who is going to be hunted in Texas to be hunted here, Ms. Stewart Cousins said. And that is all the time we have for today. I'm Brian Burgess, and I've been reading from the Wednesday, May 4th edition of the New York Times. Today's Norwalk Hour is coming up next.